Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Brad Young sitting in for Annie this afternoon until 3 o'clock. Thanks for hanging out with us today. I do have to give a shout out. Mark Cox has been texting me, and I think it's funny that when Mark Cox texts me, when we see each other at events, he always says, "Brad, you do a great job filling in. Why don't you ever fill in for me?" And my response is always the same. "Dude, at 5 o'clock in the morning, I can't put two words together, much less 3 or 4 hours of words. It's just never going to happen."
I was going to say, you got to get up really early.
I can't do that. I can't even talk until my fourth cup of coffee. But I got plenty of coffee in me now, and I want to talk to Jonathan Honig. He is a frequent guest. You've seen him. He's with thecapitalistpig.com. He's a frequent guest on Fox News talking about economic issues. Jonathan, great to talk to you again.
Hey, Brad, great to be with you. Good afternoon, and thanks for having me.
Good afternoon. I wanted to reach out to you because one of my issues that I talk about a lot, I love discussing economic issues, and the reason why this is such a crucial economic issue is because ostensibly it sounds really benevolent. We should always be increasing the minimum wage. We should increase the minimum wage as much as we can. We should be paying people more. In fact, California has instituted a special minimum wage of $20 per hour for fast food workers. But the ramifications of this, the chess implications where you have to play 3 and 4 moves ahead, are far different than the ostensibly benevolent aspect. So I wanted to talk to you, Jonathan, because the Wall Street Journal has been covering this. California has been having lots of problems, but let's just start from the beginning. Why is this a bad idea? I mean, you'd think, hey, paying people more money, isn't that a good thing? Why is it a bad idea from an economist's perspective to have this jacked up minimum wage far beyond what is reasonable given the products that are being served?
Well, you know, the minimum wage kills jobs, and that's not my estimation. In fact, that was the discovery of the Labor Department back in the 1930s when the first minimum wage was instituted. You know, wages are not arbitrary. They're not, you know, based on whim. They're not based on the feeling of the owner or the business owner. They're based on actual productivity. And if you have a minimum wage or you have a forced wage that exceeds the productivity of that particular worker, you have economic costs and you have the elimination of jobs. And that's exactly what you've always seen when you see a minimum wage a number of years ago, or California a couple of months ago, when you have a minimum wage, job losses always follow, and they have followed in California in just the last couple of months.
Mm. And to me, that's really the bottom line, Jonathan. Listen, when I'm not on the radio, my law firm is here in St. Louis. I have to run a business. I have to manage employees. I have to determine how to pay them. So I understand that personnel costs are either oftentimes, if not always, one of the greatest costs of doing business for any company. But if you look at the fast food business in particular, and California in particular, when those individuals are being paid $20 an hour, how does that impact the price of those goods and services?
Well, the goods and services go up, but even more devastatingly, Brad, the jobs and the opportunity go away. I mean, you really should call that those minimum wage increases, especially on, you know, the fast food workers, it's discrimination against low-skilled people. Businesses are forced to cut jobs to offset increased labor costs. Hurts exactly the teenagers, the young adults, people with limited experience who are just getting their foot in the door. And, you know, it's really discrimination against low-income employees, and it hurts not only them, but the job market and the economy writ large.
And to me, Jonathan, that's what's fascinating about this issue, because what is ostensibly done for benevolent reasons, we should pay more people money, let's have the government impose a minimum wage. But by doing that, a few people get extra money, and after taxes, they get almost not anything after taxes for additional money. But at the same time, that very act eliminates jobs and takes someone who was making, say, $15 an hour, now they're making $0 an hour, and that's an awful result for them.
Well, you know, the minimum wage really helps one constituency, and that is the politicians Gavin Newsom, who gets to go run out and say, you know, we raised your wage. You know, thanks to us, those evil businesses are having to pay. Covered is the reduced hours. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So what often happens if jobs aren't lost, the employers simply reduce hours. And the reduced training that comes. I mean, why is a business going to invest in training for lower wage people? They're going to look into replacing those jobs with automation or just shutting locations altogether. That's exactly what we've seen whenever we've minimum wage upped beyond what the normal market rate.
Exactly. We're talking to Jonathan Honig. He's with thecapitalistpig.com. And Jonathan, we have seen that. We've seen multiple businesses, fast food restaurants, chains that are all either reducing the number of employees or shuttering their businesses altogether. And then all of their people are out of business, out of work, going on unemployment benefits, taking money from the government that otherwise they would have been earning money. Now they're getting Social Security or unemployment benefits. But let's look at it from a different, slightly different perspective, automation. So when an employer is looking at paying $20 an hour, maybe when he was paying that person $15 an hour, it was more beneficial to have a person. But at some point, doesn't the cost of paying the employee exceed the cost of, say, putting in a kiosk or putting in an automated milkshake maker or an automated fry maker? And then that in turn also eliminates jobs, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The businesses are incentivized to invest in automation, to replace these minimum wage workers, when exactly that, the labor cost becomes too high, and it becomes too high totally artificially. You know, I mean, the point is that these are not arbitrary. They're not, you know, based on, gee, if your employer is a really good guy, he'll pay you more. You know, if the job itself only produces, let's say, $13 value, you cannot pay someone $18, $19, or $25 an hour. It's a money-losing proposition, and that's exactly what's being promoted. And, you know, that I'll go back to that line from Milton Friedman, you know, no such thing as a free lunch. You know, as you force wages up artificially, you not only force people out of a job, as you pointed to, but you also force higher costs across the board. Businesses have to raise the price on goods to compensate for those higher wages. So there's no such thing as a free lunch, and truly, if the government to improve the lot of people at the lower end of the employment scale, they should work on improving the public schools and improve their skills. That's the only way you can make more money, is improving your skills. And, you know, historically, when you look at the minimum wage, people don't earn the minimum wage for very long. It's their first job, period of time. They learn the skills to move up the ladder, if you will. So it's really more of a political issue, the minimum wage.
And that's what I want to get to. That's what I want to get to, Jonathan. You touched on the exact issue that I want to discuss now, which is long before I went to law school, I delivered newspapers when I was in middle school. I worked at a barber shop and cleaned up after closing. You know, I did these really low skill or no skill jobs, but it taught me how to handle money. It taught me how to show up on time. It taught me how to deal with customers and deal with individuals. So when you're looking here at the fast food industry, which is an entry-level job position, and the result of hiking the minimum wage artificially by government fiat results in these people either losing their jobs or never getting hired to begin with, doesn't that have a cascade effect of unintended consequences impacting those individuals who are not going to have an opportunity to learn how to deal with money, who are not going to have an opportunity to understand how to show up for work on time? Isn't this fall under the law of unintended consequences?
Oh, and who knows? You know, you don't know, but who knows? We can imagine what happens to those young people. I mean, perhaps they, you know, turn to a life of crime. Perhaps they turn to, you know, illicit substances or whatnot. I mean, you know, they don't learn exactly, as you said, you know, the skills, the discipline to show up as you did. And look, I worked for Starbucks was my first job. I don't know if it was minimum wage, but it was darn near close. But as you said, I mean, I was able to, you know, get used to the workforce, learn those skills, and it's exactly what happens. I mean, the minimum wage really disproportionately hurts those low skill entry-level people who are just starting out. And the irony is businesses like McDonald's have historically been so extraordinary about not only moving people up from minimum wage, but moving them ultimately into management and to ownership. So, you know, what this is businesses being hurt by politicians. It's politicians trying to get into, you know, the good graces of the population by, you know, saying, oh, we raised your wages. What they don't see are the jobs lost, are the passed on by those artificially high wages, as you said, brought by fiat, brought by government force, not by the marketplace itself.
We're talking to Jonathan Honig. He's with CapitalistPig.com, frequent Fox News guest. And, John, I always love it. Jonathan, I love it how you break down economic issues. And the other economic issue that comes to mind as a result of this artificial increase of the minimum wage. And listen, this isn't just going on in California. Obviously, Bernie Sanders wants to increase the minimum wage, I don't know, to $50 an hour. I mean, I don't know what it is. But whatever number is wrong if it's imposed by government and not the private sector. And certainly Kamala Harris is going to be making that same pitch. But here's the other question I want to ask you. Inflation. Right now, one of the greatest economic issues that we have in this country is inflation. So when you talk about government raising the minimum wage, how does that impact the costs that we all pay, that consumers pay for goods and services across the board?
It not only, you know, hikes the costs, but it reduces the opportunity. I mean, think about it. You're thinking about starting a business, and maybe you can only afford one or two employees. Increased labor costs is a complete discouraging formation. So there's really nothing good economically about the minimum wage. I mean, you have to search to find economic data that supports a higher minimum wage. The only one that really helps are those politicians. They get to go out and, you know, wave their hands and have a ribbon cutting ceremony and promise that this is going to alleviate poverty. And I think that's the real kind of frustrating and sad thing is that it really has a real limited impact on poverty. I mean, this doesn't translate to lifting many families out of poverty, and especially since benefits often are reduced to programs. You know, they might have to hire you for, you know, higher wage, but they reduce your hours, they reduce your benefits, they reduce your bonus because there's no such thing as a free lunch. So, you know, if government really wanted to help low-skilled employees, they would improve the thing that they have a monopoly over, and those are the schools, so people can actually learn higher skills and get better jobs.
Exactly. And that's the reason why I wanted to ask you that question, Jonathan, is because I think for many, I'm going to call them regular citizens, regular people who don't work in fast food, and they think, well, what does it matter to me if the government wants to impose a $20 minimum wage at McDonald's? But for regular people, When that minimum wage is imposed and the cost now of a Big Mac has to go up, the cost of coffee at Starbucks has to go up to pay these employees, now that regular Joe citizen may not have enough money to buy a refrigerator, buy a new car, buy a new house because of the inflationary impact of buying McDonald's burgers or Starbucks coffee.
Absolutely. I mean, it adds to the bottom line of all of us just trying to live our lives. And I mean, and it's not inflationary in the sense that it's not expanding the money supply as inflation really does, but it certainly, you know, is expensive and adds to costs and costs that have to be passed on to the consumer. So, you know, all of us now are paying. Great groceries are a great example. Somewhere on the order of 18% to 35% more for the same basket of groceries as we were just 3 or 4 years ago. You know, that's serious money, and the irony is that's the most serious money for exactly those low-skilled, low, you know, entry-level people that government and the minimum wage purport to want to help. You know, that for them, it's that higher increase and higher cost that hurts them the most. So
you're absolutely right. That's why I love talking to you. Jonathan Honig, CapitalistPig.com. If people want to track you online, read what you have to say, listen to your insight and wisdom, how can they find you online?
Thank you so much. Well, you know, I do manage money over at CapitalistPig.com, and you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and all the rest. The main link is CapitalistPig.com, and I'm always happy to join you, Brad.
Jonathan Honig, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy day to join us here on 97.1 FM Talk.
Anytime. Be well. Thanks again.
Absolutely. Hey, we've got more to come here on the Annie Fry Show. We're going to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Brad.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Alo, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Young, 97.1 FM Talk. Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Glad you're with us this afternoon. And here's one thing. We talked earlier about now the would-be presumed presidential candidate for the Dems, Kamala Harris. But I want you to listen to what she says as the campaign starts and at the convention, because here's what you're going to hear. And I'm going to challenge people to hear this. Because she will be talking about all that she will be doing, or the Democrats will be doing, for this country. But most of that's going to be done through administrative agencies of the federal government, if she were to be elected president of the United States. And yet, because of the Supreme Court that we have in place, because of the elimination of what's called the Chevron deference, which I'll talk about here in just a moment, because of those things, Much of the platform of the Democrat Party, much of what she's going to be promising, as Gilligan once said on Gilligan's Island, this, that, and the other thing, all of those things would have to be done via executive action, executive order, but that has now been truncated by the U.S. Supreme Court in the what's called the Loper-Bright decision.
Which is fantastic news.
Yes.
I mean, that's great news. And also, you're right about the promises thing, because Republicans just have to win one branch of Congress for that to stop entirely.
Exactly.
And it looks very likely that they would take the Senate. They might even hold the House. So,
yeah. And as I look at the Senate and you look at the states that are electing senators this time, we could gain lots of seats in the Senate, which, of course, would be fantastic. But think about this. Remember the eviction moratorium during COVID, where the federal government, the Biden administration, said, if you're a landlord, you cannot evict someone when they don't pay the rent, which was literally the federal government telling private property owners how to manage their business. Because if you can't evict someone and they're not paying the rent, now the person that owns that house has zero income. And I think must be from the liberal mindset that these are big corporations that are owning these houses. But aren't most rental houses owned just by regular people that have an extra house to pick up some extra income?
That's a fact. In fact, the stat is that I've heard thrown around a lot is that, well, it's BlackRock. You know, people talk about these big companies buying up all the houses. And at this moment, the last stat I heard about that is that BlackRock only owned about 11% of all rental houses, which admittedly is a lot.
Sure.
But that means that 89 to 90% of most rental houses are owned by either small or little companies or individuals.
Exactly. So the federal government was literally saying to those mom and pops who own rental property that you cannot earn a living. You cannot charge money, get a return on your investment. And the Supreme Court struck that down. Then you had the vaccine mandate, mm-hmm. where through the Department of Labor, the Biden administration said, if you work for a company with 100 or more employees, you must require everyone be vaccinated. And that was all being done by the Biden administration. Supreme Court struck that down. But now this case, it was called Loper-Bright Enterprises, came down in June. Most people roll their eyes because it wasn't a sexy issue. It's not like, overturning Roe versus Wade, or it's something that has to do with Trump on the ballot. It was something as meaningless as regulations for fisheries by fish hatchery businesses. But the implications are going to be profound, because under this Loper-Bright decision now, well, let me back up and put it this way. Before Loper-Bright, there was this thing called the Chevron deference. Under the Chevron deference, if an agency wants to say, eliminate student loan debt, okay, let's look at that for a moment. Eliminate, I'm gonna bring help and assistance to all college people who've gone to college and had to borrow money. They're having a hard time making ends meet. We're gonna bring relief to you, America. And that could be a campaign speech, right? But under that analysis, a judge would first of all have to look and say, is Congress's intent when they empowered the statute, through statute, empowered the agency, is it clear and ambiguous? If yes, they have to do exactly what Congress says. If no, the agency gets to do whatever it wants if it's ambiguous. That was the Chevron deference. So if Congress says to you, federal government, you get to manage student debt, then from the student debt agency in the Biden administration, they could say, well, eliminating student debt is the same thing as managing it, so we're going to eliminate student debt. But now, if it's unambiguous under the Supreme Court's ruling in Loper-Bright, if it's ambiguous, the agency cannot act unless they get more direction from Congress. So now it flips it. So if the government wants to say, if the next Kamala Harris administration wants to say, we're going to just wipe out all student debt across the board, she can't do it. Because unless Congress authorizes it, the agency won't be able to do it.
It's amazing that people are freaking out about that ruling, because what essentially you've just described is what the Supreme Court said is now the unelected bureaucracy doesn't have the power in this situation. It goes back to the organization that is mandated and elected by the people of
right.
the country.
And who's upset by that? The left is upset because the voters get to decide. The left doesn't want the voters to decide. Just look at presidential candidate Kamala Harris. Not a single voter in this country has chosen her to be the next presidential candidate, but she will be coronated mm-hmm. by an unelected group of individuals, power brokers in Washington, D.C., and in the major cities are going to choose that. The left doesn't want citizens to have a voice. And so that's why they would much rather have an agency filled with government bureaucrats deciding whether you can stop an entire bridge project because a snail darter might be impacted, rather than having Congress do that, who is responsible to us, we the people. And that's what the left doesn't want to have in this country.
Of course, Kamala is going to support that, because that is how she got selected. I mean, without
yes.
those people, I mean, it's not necessarily the deep state, although it could be. But we definitely know that the donors, the big donors in this country who donate to Democrat
yeah.
campaigns, they decided this.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are very well known. Some of them are George Clooney and some of the big Hollywood fundraisers that just happened a couple weeks ago. But some of them, we don't know their names. But the reason I know that they are the ones deciding this is based on public knowledge that she had a call with them Sunday morning.
Yes.
She had a call with over 800 big Democrat donors Sunday morning. We don't know exactly what was said. All that has been leaked from that is that it was run very poorly, which is an odd thing that,
yes.
that was what they were reporting on. But that call happened Sunday morning, and then Joe Biden steps down, and guess who got coronated? She did.
Right.
Because of the money.
And the thing about it is, too, what happened with the Democrat Party in the selection of the coronation of Kamala Harris isn't illegal.
No, it's not.
It's not against the Democrats' rules.
No.
And I know that there are a bunch of Democrats saying out there, there's nothing wrong with this. And it's like, not legally, not against the rules. Yeah, I get what you're saying there. But basically, they just took you out of the equation. And it's up to you to decide. If
right.
you're a Democrat voter, are you okay with not really having a voice in it and just saying, but they're wearing the right jersey, therefore
right.
I'm going to vote for
them.
But
see, it demonstrates a mindset. And now I'm going to come back and give you an additional example of this. Legal scholars who are legitimate legal scholars, you know, whenever I'm over on Camo X, I do a show Wednesday morning where I'm a legal analyst. I don't give any opinion. I just break things down. All right. I don't say whether something's good or something's bad. I lay out, here's what this decision means, and this is how it applies to us. All right. But most legal analysts aren't like that. They want to spin everything in favor of their political opinion one way or the other. But most legitimate legal analysts look at Roe v. Wade and say it's the worst decision ever
mm-hmm.
decided
yeah.
by the Supreme Court, because there's no legal foundation for how they reached that decision. It was just completely manufactured. But look how this fits into the liberal playbook, because just like we've been talking about this entire segment, where the left only wants a small group of bureaucrats to make decisions instead of those who are elected officials and answerable to the people. In 1972, when Roe versus Wade was passed or was decided, the left used five unelected members of a court to invent a new legal process to bypass Congress, to bypass every one of the 50 states in this country, to enact a nationwide policy allowing for the death of human beings at the will of the mother, because they couldn't get it through Congress. So they used a small group of unelected bureaucrats. Here it was five people wearing black robes, but it was the same mindset.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be answerable to the will of the people. I want to have a small group of people whom I control do my bidding for me in a way that they are not answerable to the public. And of course, the Supreme Court have lifetime appointments. But it's that same mindset. And now, with the Dobbs decision, didn't outlaw abortion. It said what? It said the governments of each state are empowered to decide their own views on abortion. So now we, the people, have a say, and the left is outraged. The left is beside themselves at anger and vitriol. How dare you allow an issue be decided by the people at the ballot box? And to me, that's a mindset of the left that we need to remember. As we see Kamala Harris on the campaign trail from now till November, when she's promising this, that, and the other thing, it's all going to be stuff that the federal government's going to do by unelected bureaucrats. And the only mechanism that we have to stop it isn't some right-wing fascist Supreme Court. No, no, no. It's something called the Constitution. And I applaud the Supreme Court now for upholding the Constitution in ways that our framers designed, but in ways that frustrate the left because they are, by definition, anti-constitutionalists.
What's amazing is Roe versus Wade was 1973, right?
Sorry, I said 72.
Oh, did you? Well, I was correct. I didn't even know it.
It's 73.
Because I was asking myself, 1973. So when that happened in 1973, that means that was, and 2022 is when it got overturned, so 39 years, is that about right?
Mm-hmm.
That means that they had all of that time to pass a law.
Correct.
And there were many Democrat supermajorities.
Yes.
You think back to 2008 and 2009, for instance.
Yeah.
They could have done this in multiple spots, and they didn't.
Didn't do it.
And they actually lamented that after this was overturned, because they just let unelected people create policy for them that they at some point could have addressed. But they never did, because they didn't want it attached to their names. Because up until just recently, abortion was considered something that was supposed to be very rare and was not something you really wanted to like. You know, it was something that America said, okay, that's legal, but it's supposed to be, the phrase was, safe, legal, and rare. Rare.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have abandoned that because their voters don't care anymore. And they're just going all in on abortion. But they had all this time, exactly to your point, to pass a law, and they never did it.
They never did it. And so as you, the listeners, hear Kamala Harris promising all the things that she's going to do if she were to become president, I want you to think, is that something that Congress would pass? Or is this something that she wants to enable by executive order? And if it's by an executive order, I want you to rest assured that our Constitution will protect us, hopefully, from that type of overreaching, big brother, cradle-to-grave policies that define the left in this country. The only protection we will have if she's president is the Constitution. Hey, we've got to take a break here. We're going to come back with the last segment here on the Annie Fry Show. Brad Young sitting in today, 97.1 FM Talk. Don't go away. Heading back to the Headbangers is what we're doing here. Brad Young on the last segment here of the Annie Fry Show today. You know, back when I had hair, this would have been a fun song to jam out to.
Now we hate it.
Now we hate it because, well, at least me, I got no hair. But which somebody pointed out in the chat line, that isn't it ironic? A bald guy worked in a barbershop. And listen, that irony is not lost on me, by the way. I've thought of that many, many times. But one of the topics I wanted to close out with here on the Annie Fry Show today is, you remember, this has been decades in the making, but at some point in corporate America, corporate America pretty much reflected conservative values. And then at some point, corporate America moved to embrace the left. Because, you know, when I was a kid growing up, it was always that the Republicans were the money people and the Democrats were the little people. And that's how it worked. But at some point, there was a flip. And I think that flip occurred as our universities became socialist factories and people who were being kicked out of Harvard Law, of Yale Law, of MBA programs across this country started embracing progressivism, embracing Marxism. And then when those people went out and got jobs, they tailored the social presence of the corporations to progressive ideals. And so we were being just pounded with social activism from corporate America. But, you know, there's something I've noticed that in the last couple of years, we're seeing a move away from corporate America on this. Let me throw out these examples and then let's talk about it. These are just five examples that I came up with here in the last few weeks. Bud Light continues to lose more ground. They're now number three beer in America because of Dylan Mulvaney. We also have John Deere that's backing away from diversity and inclusion efforts after a conservative backlash, which, by the way, John Deere, who are their customers?
Know your audience, John
know
Deere.
Know your audience.
Well, it sounds like they have. They figured it out.
Now they figured it out. You also have a company called Tractor Supply.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Okay.
What?
Tractor Supply, they used to warn that climate change and lack of diversity would hurt their business, but now they're completely abandoning those things because embracing these radical progressive ideas hurt their bottom line. Target now is dialing back on Pride merchandise, and it was just this week, Microsoft of all companies, that they're laying off their entire DEI team because it was hurting business operations.
Wow.
So what do you think about this in terms of the shift that we had corporate America previously embracing more or less conservative ideals, maybe not strongly, but somewhat. Then it shifted to this embrace of progressive ideas. And now we see corporate America shifting back from that. What do you think of that trend?
Well, it's a big deal. That's a big, big deal. And it started with Bud Light. It really did. And at the time, I remember reporting on this, and we would ask the question, you know, like we do in the polls, you know, is this having an impact? I think the answer was almost always yes. We're seeing the reverberation from that still happening now. But I don't think it's just that. I don't think corporations just said, ooh, look what happened to them. We don't want that to happen to us. I think there's been a shift. Culturally, you can feel that there is a major pushback on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, because people have realized that those words sound good. The implementation of the policies hurts everybody because it takes everything away from merit-based hiring.
Yeah.
It takes, and here's what's terrible. It actually hurts the people that it claims to help the most.
Yes, just like what we talked about with the minimum wage when I was interviewing Jonathan Honig about how by instituting a mandatory minimum wage ostensibly designed to help people, you're really hurting the very people that you're trying to help.
Yeah, but it for a long time it didn't matter because it made power brokers feel good. And we're at a point now where I think that cultural shift has happened. And I mean, I didn't know about the Microsoft news. That's huge.
Yes, it is.
I had heard about some of those others, including John Deere, but the Microsoft one is big because that is not a tractor supply company.
No, it's not.
that is a company that has probably been one of the leaders. I mean, I'm assuming that they're Silicon Valley, or at least they're adjacent to being in that world. Well, if that world starts to turn, and they're, you know, this is the most liberal part of the country in California.
Well, Microsoft isn't in California. They're in Oregon, Washington.
Washington, Pacific Northwest. Thank you for that.
Way.
Because last week, though, we were reporting on, and this was with Ryan Recker filling in, we were reporting on all the Silicon Valley companies that are doing the same thing. Now, they might not be eliminating the programs entirely, but they're definitely dialing them back, and they're seeing that there's been a shift. I'm not going to give Ron DeSantis all of the credit for that, but he deserves some of the credit for making that a big, big issue, and he took a lot of heat for that.
Yes.
And everybody has kind of decided, yeah, but you're making good points. Even if I disagree with the way you did it, which I don't, but even if I do,
you know, you're actually making decent points. When you find that people are in positions that they shouldn't be in over and over just because of outward characteristics, that is the opposite of the civil rights movement.
You're right. It is, because the civil rights movement is supposed to give people equal access. And here's what the left doesn't understand, specifically what the left does not understand. They look at, and they would look at the conversation we're having now, they would look at this reduced emphasis on DEI, and the left would say, you're taking that position because you're discriminatory, and you don't want minorities, and you don't want women to succeed in the workplace. Nothing could be further from the truth. I want minorities to succeed. I want women to succeed. But I want them to succeed based upon merit, not based upon quotas. Mm-hmm. Because if people get positions because of quotas, then they have no incentive to work the same way that someone who is promoted based upon merit has to do. Thomas Sowell, one of the greatest economists ever lived, I've read multiple of his books. He said this. I heard him say one time that I'm concerned that when people see me, that they think I am a great economist only because of the color of my skin, and I've been put into a position because of the color of my skin, not based upon the merit of my work. And that, to me, defines the problem with DEI, and the left simply cannot grasp that simple reality that we've just been discussing.
It's sad because you take away people's integrity simply by forcing these policies into place. Because like you said, now you're forcing, it's not just the right. I mean, everybody asks these questions now. You go, well, did you get the job because of your qualifications, or did you get the job because you checked some boxes? It's not just a right-wing thing. Right. This is a social thing that has happened. And it's unfortunate because maybe that person actually does deserve that job, and they should be lauded for getting, you know, a big, big job, especially. You know, there's a lot of DEI in Hollywood.
Right, but let's look at this as an example, Ryan, just to bolster what you're saying. I was outraged when President Biden stood up and said, the next appointment to the Supreme Court mm-hmm. is going to be a black female, all right? Automatically, by doing that, I don't know Ketanji Brown Jackson. All I know is that she's not a biologist. But however, she may be a fantastic legal scholar. She hasn't been there on the court long enough for me to know that. But she will forever, in my mind, be a quota appointment because Biden wasn't looking for the best person for the job. He was looking for the best black woman for the job. And I don't know, she might have been the best person, but because of Biden's qualifications, we're never going to know that.
And here's a question. I really am asking the left this question. How do you think that makes her feel? She is a Supreme Court justice. She will be for the rest of her life as long as she wants to be. She should be at the peak of her career. She should walk in any room. She probably still does. And people think, wow,
yep.
She has accomplished something. But now there's this nagging question. Was she the best? Was she the best?
Was she?
And she's got to deal with that for the rest of her life.
Yes.
Now, because of bad policy, and it's to make people feel better. People in positions of power feel better when they can make these things happen because they go, oh, look how great I am. It eases my conscience. But then you just did this to this woman for the rest of her life that she has to answer that question, even mm-hmm. if not publicly. Privately, she, you know, people might ask that no matter where she's at, and she never really knows, but she's got to answer for it.
Well, I've given this example before on a previous time I've hosted and sat in for Annie, and it's this. The American Bar Association wants to impose a rule on law schools that says that the professors at the law school has to match the diversity of the community. When I was in law school, St. Louis University, approximately one-third of my law professors were Jewish. Last time I checked the stats, about 2% of Americans are Jewish. So does that mean now that if you adopt that American Bar Association platform, that the dean of the law school is going to have to go to a Jewish law professor and say, you know what, I'm very sorry. You're a great law professor, but we have to fire you because you're Jewish. And that those are the consequences mm-hmm. of this belief system that is flawed at its core by picking people by their characteristics of their skin or their gender or other issues other than merit.
Yeah, what started with equal opportunity, and you'll still hear it announced, oh, we're an equal opportunity employer. That's good.
That's fantastic.
That's what you want. You want to have equal opportunity for everybody. But it, of course, it didn't stop there because it never does. Once you get some power, these people, oh, you got some power, they push it up further, and it becomes equal outcome. And then you get them replacing words like diversity with equity, or equality with equity.
Correct.
And you go, well, okay, you're just flipping the script a little bit because you're trying to do something else now that's beyond what we all kind of agreed was a good thing. Now you're doing something else, and we don't agree on that.
Right. And so I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled that now corporate America is reassessing this embracing of progressive ideas, because here's what they don't understand. Remember, during World War II, the Christians were very slow to embrace the protection of the Jews in Nazi Germany. And it wasn't until the Christians themselves started being jailed by the Nazi regime did they regret not standing up for the Jews. In today's corporate America, if they embrace progressive ideas, then that means socialism will be taking them away.
The results of the poll, how does Kamala's candidacy change the Democrats' chances of winning in 2024?
With 260 votes, 55% of you said that she makes it better.
So, okay, our audience, at least by a narrow majority, believes that their chances are better now.
How much better or how much worse?
So let it be written. So let it be done.
It is done.
Brad Young sitting in today on the Annie Fry Show. We've got more great stuff coming up here on 97.1 FM Talk. Mark Reardon Show coming up next. Thanks so much for sticking around with us today. I will talk to you soon. Type of overreaching, big brother, cradle-to-grave policies that define the left in this country. The only protection we will have if she's president is the Constitution. Hey, we've got to take a break here. We're going to come back with the last segment here on the Annie Fry Show. Brad Young sitting in today, 97.1 FM Talk. Don't go away. Heading back to the Headbangers is what we're doing here. Brad Young on the last segment here of the Annie Fry Show today. You know, back when I had hair, this would have been a fun song to jam out to.
Now we hate it.
Now we hate it because, well, at least me, I got no hair. But which somebody pointed out in the chat line that isn't it ironic? A bald guy worked in a barbershop. And listen, that irony is not lost on me, by the way. I've thought of that many, many times. But one of the topics I wanted to close out with here on the Annie Fry Show today is, you remember, this has been decades in the making, but at some point in corporate America pretty much reflected conservative values. And then at some point, corporate America moved to embrace the left. Because, you know, when I was a kid growing up, it was always that the Republicans were the money people and the Democrats were the little people. And that's how it worked. But at some point, there was a flip. And I think that flip occurred as our universities became socialist factories, and people who were being kicked out of Harvard Law, of Yale Law, of MBA programs across this country started embracing progressivism, embracing Marxism. And then when those people went out and got jobs, they tailored the social presence of the corporations to progressive ideals. And so we were being just pounded with social activism from corporate America. But, you know, there's something I've noticed that in the last couple of years, we're seeing a move away from corporate America on this. Let me throw out these examples and then let's talk about it. These are just five examples that I came up with here in the last few weeks. Bud Light continues to lose more ground. They're now number three beer in America because of Dylan Mulvaney. We also have John Deere is backing away from diversity and inclusion efforts after a conservative backlash, which, by the way, John Deere, who are their customers?
Know your audience, John Deere. Well, it sounds like they figured it out.
You also have a company called Tractor Supply.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Okay. Tractor Supply, they used to warn that climate change and lack of diversity would hurt their business, but now they're completely abandoning those things because embracing these radical progressive ideas hurt their bottom line. Target now is dialing back on Pride merchandise. And it was just this week, Microsoft of all companies, that they're laying off their entire DEI team because it was hurting business operations.
Wow.
So what do you think about this in terms of the shift that we had corporate America previously embracing more or less conservative ideals, maybe not strongly, but somewhat. Then it shifted to this embrace of progressive ideas. And now we see corporate America shifting back from that. What do you think of that trend?
Well, it's a big deal. That's a big, big deal. And it started with Bud Light. It really did. And at the time, I remember reporting on this, and we would ask the question, you know, like we do in the polls, you know, is this having an impact? I think the answer was almost always yes. We're seeing the reverberation from that still happening now. But I don't think it's just that. I don't think corporations just said, ooh, look what happened to them. We don't want that to happen to us. I think there's been a shift. Culturally, you can feel that there is a major pushback on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, because people have realized that those words sound good. The implementation of the policies hurts everybody because it takes everything away from merit-based hiring. Yeah. It takes, and here's what's terrible. It actually hurts the people that it claims to help the most.
Yes, just like what we talked about with the minimum wage when I was interviewing Jonathan Honig about how by instituting a mandatory minimum wage ostensibly designed to help people, you're really hurting the very people that you're trying to help.
Yeah, but it for a long time it didn't matter because it made power brokers feel good. And we're at a point now where I think that cultural shift has happened. And I mean, I didn't know about the Microsoft news. That's huge.
Yes, it is.
I had heard about some of those others, including John Deere, but the Microsoft one is big because that is not a tractor supply company.
No, it's not.
that is a company that has probably been one of the leaders. I mean, I'm assuming that they're Silicon Valley, or at least they're adjacent to being in that world. Well, if that world starts to turn, and they're, you know, this is the most liberal part of the country in California.
Well, Microsoft isn't in California. They're in
Oregon,
Washington, Pacific Northwest. Which is,
thank you for that.
Way.
Because last week, though, we were reporting on, and this was with Ryan Recker filling in, we were reporting on all the Silicon Valley companies that are doing the same thing. Now, they might not be eliminating the programs entirely, but they're definitely dialing them back, and they're seeing that there's been a shift. I'm not going to give Ron DeSantis all of the credit for that, but he deserves some of the credit for making that a big, big issue, and he took a lot of heat for that.
Yes.
And everybody has kind of decided, yeah, but you're making good points. Even if I disagree with the way you did it, which I don't, but even if I do, you know, you're actually making decent points. When you find that people are in positions that they shouldn't be in over and over just because of outward characteristics, that is the opposite of the civil rights movement.
You're right. It is, because the civil rights movement is supposed to give people equal access. And here's what the left doesn't understand, specifically what the left does not understand. They look at, and they would look at the conversation we're having now, they would look at this reduced emphasis on DEI, and the left would say, you're taking that position because you're discriminatory, and you don't want minorities, and you don't want women to succeed in the workplace. Nothing could be further from the truth. I want minorities to succeed. I want women to succeed. But I want them to succeed based upon merit, not based upon quotas. Mm-hmm. Because if people get positions because of quotas, then they have no incentive to work the same way that someone who is promoted based upon merit has to do. Thomas Sowell, one of the greatest economists ever lived, I've read multiple of his books, he said this. I heard him say one time that I'm concerned that when people see me, that they think I am a great economist only because of the color of my skin, and I've been put into a position because of the color of my skin, not based upon the merit of my work. And that, to me, defines the problem with DEI, and the left simply cannot grasp that simple reality that we've just been discussing.
It's sad because you take away people's integrity simply by forcing these policies into place. Because like you said, now you're forcing, it's not just the right. I mean, everybody asks these questions now. You go, well, did you get the job because of your qualifications, or did you get the job because you checked some boxes? It's not just a right-wing thing. Right. This is a social thing that has happened. And it's unfortunate because maybe that person actually does deserve that job, and they should be lauded for getting, you know, a big, big job, especially.
You know, there's a lot of DEI in Hollywood.
Right. But let's look at this as an example, Ryan, just to bolster what you're saying. I was outraged when President Biden stood up and said, I'm going to, the next appointment to the Supreme Court is going to be a black female. All right. Automatically, by doing that, I don't know Ketanji Brown Jackson. All I know is that she's not a biologist. But however, she may be a fantastic legal scholar. She hasn't been there on the court long enough for me to know that. But she will forever, in my mind, be a quota appointment because Biden wasn't looking for the best person for the job. He was looking for the best black woman for the job. And I don't know, she might have been the best person, but because of Biden's qualifications, we're never going to know that.
And here's a question. I really am asking the left this question. How do you think that makes her feel? She is a Supreme Court justice. She will be for the rest of her life as long as she wants to be. She should be at the peak of her career. She should walk in any room. She probably still does. And people think, wow, she has accomplished something. But now there's this nagging question. Was she the best? Was she the best?
Was she?
And she's got to deal with that for the rest of her life.
Yes.
Now, because of bad policy, and it's to make people feel better. People in positions of power feel better when they can make these things happen because they go, oh, look how great I am. It eases my conscience. But then you just did this to this woman for the rest of her life that she has to answer that question, even if not publicly, but privately. She, you know, people might ask that no matter where she's at, and she never really knows. But she's got to answer for it.
Well, I've given this example before on a previous time I've hosted and sat in for Annie, and it's this. The American Bar Association wants to impose a rule on law schools that says that the professors at the law school has to match the diversity of the community. When I was in law school, St. Louis University, approximately one-third of my law professors were Jewish. Last time I checked the stats, about 2% of Americans are Jewish. So does that mean now that if you adopt that American Bar Association platform, that the dean of the law school is going to have to go to a Jewish law professor and say, you know what, I'm very sorry. You're a great law professor, but we have to fire you because you're Jewish. And those are the consequences of this belief system that is flawed at its core by picking people by their characteristics of their skin or their gender or other issues other than merit.
Yeah, what started with equal opportunity, and you'll still hear it announced, oh, we're an equal opportunity employer. That's good.
That's fantastic.
That's what you want. You want to have equal opportunity for everybody. But it, of course, it didn't stop there because it never does. Once you get some power, these people, oh, you got some power, they push it up further, and it becomes equal outcome. And then you get them replacing words like diversity with equity or equality with equity.
Correct.
And you go, well, okay, you're just flipping the script a little bit because you're trying to do something else now that's beyond what we all kind of agreed was a good thing. Now you're doing something else and we don't agree on that.
Right. And so I'm thrilled that now corporate America is reassessing this embracing of progressive ideas because here's what they don't understand. Remember, during World War II, the Christians were very slow to embrace the protection of the Jews in Nazi Germany. And it wasn't until the Christians themselves started being jailed by the Nazi regime did they regret not standing up for the Jews. In today's corporate America, if they embrace progressive ideas, then that means socialism will be taking them away.
The results of the poll, how does Kamala's candidacy change the Democrats' chances of winning in 2024?
With 260 votes, 55% of you said that she makes it better.
So, okay, our audience, at least by a narrow majority, believes that their
and
chances
we didn't
are
say
better now.
How much better or how much worse?
So let it be written. So let it be done.
It is done.
Brad Young sitting in today on the Annie Fry Show. We've got more great stuff coming up here on 97.1 FM Talk. Mark Reardon Show coming up next. Thanks so much for sticking around with us today. I will talk to you soon.